Welcome to the Fair Parenting Podcast, where we cover people's stories, ideas, and the progress towards fair parenting.
Welcome to the podcast. Today we're talking with Positive Conclusions. We recorded this episode a few weeks ago and we had a really long chat, so long in fact that we decided to release it as two episodes, with part one today and part two in 2 weeks' time. One thing, the first few minutes, there's a few audio glitches due to a technical problem we had, but they get much better after the first few minutes. And the content's so good, thanks to our guest, I thought we'd leave it in. Okay, so let's listen to part one and I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to the podcast. Today we're talking with Positive Conclusions, who works in the UK to reform the family courts and put children and families first. Positive Conclusions works closely with the Family Court Reform Coalition, whose website is fcrc.uk. We interviewed Mike Bell from there in episode 7. I see on Positive Conclusions' website that many organisations have endorsed the FCRC UK report. It's great to see good people, men and women, coming together to help bring positive reform for the benefit of all of us, including children. Okay, so welcome, Positive Conclusions, to the podcast. It's very good to have you here. You do a lot of work with the Family Court Reform Coalition. I know that one of the things you wanted to cover in this episode was the history of domestic abuse and how that the definition of abuse has changed over the decades and the effects that might have in the family court and on the definition of significant harm to children. Do you want to tell us a bit about your views on that?
Yeah, so a long time ago, domestic abuse in the household was just considered normal. The fathers in households were basically the head of the household, and beating children and beating women was just considered okay in the household. Obviously, that's changed. It changed. The first act was in the 1880s, but you know, there was the Domestic Violence Act in 1976, and we've been making strides to improve the Domestic Abuse Act, and we still are doing so. However, I do feel that there are some issues with how it's evolved and where that leads us now. So, for example, in 1986, schools could no longer use corporal punishment. So, therefore, anyone that was in school before 1986 could be hit by a teacher. Now we think of that as completely wrong. However, that means you'll have some judges in family courts that went to school at those times. You'll have judges that it would have been normal for them, when they were bringing up their kids, to shout at their children or to hit their children. It would have just been considered discipline, good discipline back then. And it isn't now. It's not considered that. So I do feel like there are some issues there. I'm a teacher and I'm against physical punishment. I'm against negative reinforcement as well. I don't think it works anywhere near as well as positive reinforcement. However,
yes,
in the family courts, I do feel that there's been some issues, because everything that is considered domestic abuse is considered significant harm to the child, but it seems like it's pretty much all at the same level in the family court. So, for instance, if there's an argument in the family home, and there's shouting or swearing, that's considered domestic abuse in the household, and the child is now considered a victim of domestic abuse. And I'm not arguing the fact that that may be true. However, what I would suggest is there's different levels of harm to the child. So removing a parent from a child's life is significantly harmful to a child. I think everybody would agree with that. Even the judges in family courts agree it's harmful to the child to lose a parent.
Yes.
It should only happen in extreme cases. However, It doesn't only happen in extreme cases. It happens in most cases to go to family court where there's an allegation of domestic abuse. And it's just the allegation. It doesn't need to have even been proved at that point. It can take 2 years to prove or to nullify that allegation. So that's 2 years where a child may have had their contact with their parent either completely stopped, or if not completely stopped, they might be in a contact center or limited, or video calls or phone calls.
Yes.
Really damaging to the child. And I would just question whether some of the reasons are valid reasons to stop that contact. I would suggest in any case where there's allegations of domestic abuse, that there are contact centres that are safe places to have contact with children, with professionals there present. Mm. That should be the minimum. I think that should be the minimum, that you should be able to see your child in a contact centre. If there's no convictions against you and there's only been allegations and they've not been proven, I don't see how using a contact centre shouldn't be at least a bare minimum for a child to at least maintain some kind of contact with their physical contact with their parent.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I just talk about my own case. It followed a fairly well-trodden blueprint. You know, first court hearing, the parent alleges domestic violence, and it's they demand contact centres, which they then say they can't pay for. And so I end up having to go to a contact centre. The other parent forbids friends and family from seeing the child for some reason. We still don't know why they said that. But I had to pay for the contact centres. There was never any proof of any...
Yeah, it's always the alleged parent is always the one that has to pay for the contact.
It is,
I've heard in some cases where the female is the person that's been alleged to have been the abuser, it's actually split 50-50, actually, the cost.
Ah, okay.
In some cases, which I don't understand how that could be. I don't see how that's equality.
No.
I do feel like if the person's accusing had to pay like 25% to make sure that the child was safe to have contact with their other parent, that suddenly they might think twice about whether they actually wanted to make these allegations, if they were false allegations.
Yes.
I mean, if they're real allegations, I'm sure they'd carry on with them. Mm. But if they're false allegations and they're using them to get some kind of benefit, which we might go into later in the podcast, but if they're false allegations and they know that actually it's going to cost them, I don't know, £20 every month in order to ensure that your child can have safe contact with their other parent, you might see that they're like, actually, maybe we might make that allegation.
Yes. It's a lack of consequences. Even when allegations are found to be false, nothing really seems to happen. But what has happened, as you mentioned, is time has passed and a status quo has developed. And then the person who's made the false allegations can say, well, the child has got into a routine. It's harmful to the child to change that routine. And you sink further into the quicksand of the family court. That's
exactly one of the reasons why solicitors and some resident parents use many, many delay tactics with courts, and they try to encourage adjournments.
Yeah.
Every adjournment could take 3-4 months to get the next hearing in place because it's chock-a-block in the courts, family courts. That's an extra 3 or 4 months where you can, underpin the fact that you are the resident parent and that's the status quo. And then if it came out that actually, neither parent's been abusive, the child is safe for both parents. However, the child's actually been living with this parent for 2.5 years or 3 years. Mm. And they're in the school that's close here, so you might as well just keep them with that parent. And then the other parent can just visit every other weekend.
Yeah, it's just so it's so blatant and transparent and obvious that what goes on. You wonder how courts and judges put up with it. But in my case, we had the fact find when my child was 2.5 years old. The false allegations had been going on pretty much from birth. And the other parent then managed to cause delay after delay. And so my child now is 4 and a half. So the parent, the other parent was found guilty of alienating behaviour and false allegations and all sorts of things. It took over two years to get that judgment in court, and almost 2 years later, we're still awaiting the final hearing. It's bonkers. But yeah, you know, the delays are totally strategic, because what's happened now is my child's gone from being 2 and a half, when they've established who the abusive party is.
Yeah, I wanted to just add a little bit about the definition of domestic abuse. Is that actually there isn't a legal definition of domestic abuse. And that's a problem. It's definitely a problem, because that means that there's too much room for people to make their own minds up about what is and what isn't, and you know, who can and who can't be. So if you've got a judge, and one judge might think shouting at a child is horrendous domestic abuse, and another judge might just think, well, you know, I shouted at my kids, so it's not that bad. There needs to be some kind of consistency.
I think we were going to talk next about incentivized allegations. And yeah. I think we covered that a little bit there already with the way that, you know, somebody who makes false allegations can use those from the word go, and they're incentivized because there's no consequence once their lies are exposed, but also that a status quo is developed, which then helps them to win the case or possibly win the case. What other ways are they incentivized to make these allegations?
Well, if you think about it, even from the offset, right at the very beginning, if you make an allegation of domestic abuse, regardless of whether you're the mother or the father, that you've got more chance of becoming the resident parent from the offset. So that being the resident parent when you're in the family court is a huge advantage. Whether you're the father or the mother. I mean, we can talk about sexism in the family courts, but regardless of it at all, if you just take it as resident parent and non-resident parent, regardless of their gender, there's a massive advantage being the resident parent. And that's written into the practice directions. You're basically presumed to be the innocent party in practice directions if you're the resident parent, and you're presumed to be abusive almost in the practice directions, but you are definitely presumed to be innocent. So even if there are counter allegations against the resident parent, they're not really taken seriously. They're already automatically considered to be the victim, and that's in practice, and that's in the practice directions 12J. So that document causes a lot of problems. Part of the work that we've been doing with the Family Court Reform Coalition and Positive Conclusions is looking at the practice directions, and we work with a gentleman from Families Need Fathers as well, and he's done a lot of work on going through with a fine-tooth comb the practice directions 12J and finding all of the problems with it. And it's still a work in progress. We've almost finished it now, but I say we, he's done all of the work. We've just been a soundboard for him. But it really does open your eyes, as actually this is why people think the family courts are sexist, because the majority of resident parents are mothers. So therefore, if the practice directions are telling the family courts to be biased towards the resident parent, mostly 90% of those cases, that's the female. So it feels like it's sexist, but there's nothing sexist in the law. The law isn't sexist. It's just how it's implemented. And I guess because from the offset, most resident parents are mothers, it does create sexism within the family courts, because there's a presumption. Then there's a presumption because statistics start weighing up, and they start seeing so many cases where the mother ends up being the resident parent. So that's considered the norm. So then even if you did even if you are the resident parent as a father, it's more difficult because of those systemic sexist views that have been built on decades, if not centuries, of beliefs that the mother should be with the child and the father should be out working.
Yes.
A lot of people say the law isn't sexist, and it isn't. The law, there's nothing in the family law that says anything that's sexist.
No.
But implemented, certainly, there are. That's why people presume it is or feel it is.
Yes, I mean, I could do an episode on my own about Practice Direction 12J. It cost me almost a year of my case and tens of thousands of pounds, actually. But that's perhaps for another day.
I'll have a chat with the gentleman. I'm not going to name names, but just in case he hasn't given me permission. But I'll have a chat with him. I'll be speaking to him on Tuesday, hopefully. So I'll let him know, and then maybe you could do a podcast with him.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, we ended up in the Royal Courts of Justice, in my case, over 12J. So, yeah, I'd be happy if he wanted to. I agree. There's no sexism in the law. I mean, that's true of all sorts of things, such as equal pay, equal opportunities. But as we know, the law, you know, things don't always play out in an equal way, even if the law is not biased. You know, the outcomes can be biased by people applying things in whatever, for whatever reason, coming out in a slightly unequal way. And I'm not talking just about the family court. I'm talking about, you know, we know that women get paid less than men. Well, why? They shouldn't do. And equal opportunities for ethnic minorities and disabled people, we know they get a raw deal and they shouldn't do. And the law says they shouldn't do, but they still do. And really, you know, equality is, you know, if you're in favour of it, you're in favour of it across the board, really. It shouldn't be something that we're selective about. And I just think as society, we need to get to that stage and say, well, I may not be in that group that's being talked about, but if it's in a matter of equality, then I'm on their side, you know. And I think if we got to that, you know, I don't want to sound a bit sort of, you know, we're hoping for a perfect world, but I think if we could get a little bit more to that level, then I think it would have benefits, not just in the family court, but across the society.
Yeah, if you think about racism in this country, and then you think about the laws, and then you think, well, hold on, the laws are there, so racism shouldn't be happening. But we, as a society, know that you need to do more than just have the laws. We need to support people of colour into certain professions. You need to incentivize it. You need to make it easier for them to get the get places into universities because they've been held back so much. Because, for example, if we look at book writers, like children's authors or something like that, most of them are white. So if we want to have children's books that have been written by people of colour, that have got people of colour as characters in them, that means we need more people of colour that are authors, that are getting opportunities. Now, there's plenty of people out there that can write books, but people that get the opportunities to get their books into supermarkets and Waterstones or whatever, that's a smaller select of people, most of them being white. So there's no law saying that only white people should be getting into Waterstones. But we know as a society that we need to do more to help those people that are equally talented to get their books on the shelves so that they've got an equal voice as well. And it's really important in education as well, because we've got a multi-ethnic country here. So we've got children from all around the world. So we want them to see themselves being doctors or vets or being scientists. We don't just want them to just see white people being scientists. So as educators, we're aware of that. And then now we've got to a point where we are trying to encourage that a lot more. But in family in families, you don't see people trying to encourage dads to be involved in their children. And I think that's the next step. If you really believe in equality, if you believe fathers and mothers are equally important as parents, we need to be making it more achievable for a father to be a father and be active in their child's life.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, we're recording this on the 15th of March, 2023. It was budget day today, and they announced the childcare, increase in childcare for, I think it's children from 9 months to 2 years. And I think they get 30 hours of childcare paid for now, as of today or whenever the announcement was today. It was interesting to see the amount of references to how that supports mothers in the news and online, and there was very few references to how that might support fathers and that fathers might benefit from having childcare. It's still
it's poor use of terminology, isn't it? Because you shouldn't be using the word mother, even if there's only one father out there that's doing it. You're labelling him as a mother because he's doing the job that you're presuming is a mother's job. It's not a mother's job. Yeah. It's a parent's job. And I know plenty of dads that have raised their kids because their partner had a higher paying job. So the female partner carried on working and he then would stay at home and look after the child. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, why do we just talk about it benefiting mothers when it actually just benefits parents?
Yeah, and I think in Scandinavia, they're a little bit more equal in the way they do that sort of provision of childcare and paternity leave and things like that. And it's funny in this country, we are, you know, because almost every day you see a story about people being criticised for using the wrong pronouns towards, say, trans people. And I don't want to get into track, you know, that's a, you know, the whole topic on its own, and people can obviously identify and call, you know, have their own pronouns, and that's all fine. But it's an interesting area because people are in society have moved to a stage where they're very, very specific on certain parts of language and certain parts of, say, gender reference, but in this area, we're still decades behind, and so it's not.
Yeah, I think there's a reason for that though. I think it's because if you use the wrong terminology that offends a certain group, there'll be a backlash. Whereas if you use the wrong terminology towards another group, say men, there's not a backlash.
Yeah.
There's no backlash. Yeah. You're not going to be cancelled. Like Fiona Bruce was basically had to leave her job, and she's a feminist. Yeah. And she's a strong feminist, and she said one thing that was out of line towards Women's Aid, and she's had to step down from her post. This is how powerful organisations like Women's Aid are. There aren't powerful organisations like that in the equal parenting kind of sphere. We want equality. We don't want to destroy people because they've got a different view.
Yes.
That does. I think that is why you see this kind of cancel culture. If you say the wrong thing towards a certain group of people, whereas you won't see that when they're saying mothers are going to benefit from this childcare, when actually you mean parents are going to benefit from this childcare.
Yes.
And even if the father is the one that's out working and the mother is the one that's staying home, the father's still benefiting from the mother being able to stay at home with their child.
Yeah.
I know there are working women who feel societal pressure on to conform to the role of being the stay-at-home mum, and they shouldn't. You know, so it does work against women there, as well as, you know, the family courts can work against women. So it's not a gender thing at all. You know, a working woman should be allowed to carry on being a working woman when she becomes a parent. And if that means the father stays at home and the couple are happy with that, that's fine. And it just seems that we're just we just haven't quite got there as a society, really.
Yeah, I mean, that seems completely normal to me, but I grew up with two working parents, so I'm not quite sure why there's still this idea that women have to be at home looking after the child where the father goes off. It feels very archaic to me, and it does feel like something in the family courts that is just considered a given, that dad will go out making money and mum will stay at home looking after the child. Even if the children are at school, dad's paying child maintenance because that's his job, is to fund the child. He can see the child maybe every other weekend because his main job is provider. Mum's main job is to be there for the children. And that's just wrong. Is that sexist?
Yeah, because we've run so far into, you know, we're so far into the future with so many other areas of life. But in this area, we just seem stuck in the 20th century or even 19th, maybe. You know, I don't understand it, really. Yeah.
I almost feel like we've actually gone backwards. And that's probably partly because family breakdown's more common. So maybe when we were younger, it was more backward because more men went to work and more mums stayed at home with the kids. However, they were intact families more often. Whereas now, there's like 50% of families are broken families now. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
23%. Yeah. It was 23% of families are now headed by a single parent. And that's crazy. 23% of families in the UK are headed by single parents, and 90% of those are single mothers. And then we can go on to the dangers for society of that as well.
Yes.
Because that has a significant impact on society as a whole when children are being brought up by single parents. Whilst this is true when looking at statistics, it is important to note that single parents can and do also raise healthy, happy children who have equally good outcomes. When solo parent families have the right support in place and a positive ethos in their parenting, such as single parents by choice, those who have involved family members like aunts, uncles and grandparents or supportive role models, the child can see how healthy relationships should look. Which can have positive outcomes. However, there are too many single parent families whereby they either don't have the support or simply refuse to engage with the other parent, which would help the child develop in a more healthy and secure way. The support needs to be more available, and those who deny healthy relationships with the other parent should be held accountable. It's also important to note the role of poverty in these cases, which lead to worse outcomes more often for single mothers compared to single fathers.
Yeah, I mean, without wanting to sound cynical, those figures you've just quoted tell me that it's an absolutely fantastic time to be a family law solicitor. Talk about a growing market. But yes, anyway, perhaps do another podcast on solicitors at another date.
I often say... in family court, there's no winners. The mother's not going to win. The father's not going to win. The child's not going to win. But the lawyers do win. They win a lot.
I mean, I was in a case, I was in a hearing a few months ago. We had a CAFCAS officer. We had a senior judge. We had two sets of offline solicitors, one for the child and one for the mother. We had two sets of barristers, one for the child, one for the mother, and I had a barrister. I was the only one paying in that hearing. You had,
the rest of it's coming out from the taxpayers' money, isn't it?
Fantastic business for the lawyers. And the chief point that that hearing was for was whether my child could go on a foreign holiday with me. The child wanted to. CAFCAS said it's fine. The child's barrister said it's fine. Only the mother said it's not. And because of that, and we had a court order from 2019 that said the holiday was allowed. The mother just said that she wasn't going to allow it.
And so we had all of those barristers, all of those solicitors. It cost me thousands of pounds.
What a waste of your money, but what a waste of the taxpayers' money as well. And I hope people that are listening realise how much tax is wasted on the family courts. It's crazy.
What happened after that was even more bizarre, because the judge, we're talking a senior circuit judge here, said, yes, you can have the holiday. The mother then delayed the draft court order for 9 weeks, by which time the flights had gone up so much. We were so close to the flight date, I couldn't afford the flights. So she got what she wanted. My barrister said he wrote to the judge. He said, I've never seen this happen before.
Well, I mean, what I would suggest to people now, I mean, in hindsight for you as well, is just I wouldn't go to family court for something like that, because family court just takes too long. And it's too easy to delay. It's too easy. I mean, she could just not. She could just turn up and just say, I need an extension. And the judge will be like, okay, we can't go ahead. We'll just have to reschedule for 4 months' time. Well, okay. Yes. But then the holidays have already passed and we don't need the hearing anymore. So, I mean, so many times it's so easy to delay. But going back to where I said 23% of families are now headed by a single parent. In the EU, the average is only 13%. So what are we doing wrong in this country? And so many of these single parent homes don't need to be single parent homes. A lot of them, there are two parents. So we really do need to be encouraging both parents to be involved in the child's life, because we know that it damages children if they're brought up in single mother homes specifically. Because if children grow up without a dad, it really does harm them quite a lot, because they're more likely to have eating disorders. They're more likely to have depression. They're more likely to struggle to maintain relationships when they're older. They're more likely to be sexually active earlier or have teenage pregnancies. They actually physically reach puberty earlier. They do worse at school. On average, there's a higher risk of being exploited by gangs or being abused. There's a higher chance of them getting involved in drugs. If you listen to all of that and you think that that's okay, there's something wrong with you, you know?
Yes.
And this all then, these people grow up to become adults.
Yes.
Broken adults in society. And if you think about the prisons, I think it's 75% of prisoners are from fatherless homes. We can see what the problem is in society. We need more. I mean, some people don't have a choice because their father's not around, or they are abusive and they're not good. But we do need to have more positive male role models involved in children's upbringing, whether that's a grandparent, uncle, or a family friend, or stepfather, or somebody like that. There's a charity called, I'm not sure if you heard of it, it's called Lads Need Dads.
Yeah,
and they provide like mentors for young, I think it's mainly for young boys. But it is a serious issue in society. And the family courts in this country are making it 100 times worse, making it much harder for dads to be part of their kids' lives. And that's why you see a lot of dads give up on family court, because if it costs them, I mean, it can cost you thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds before you've even got anywhere, and all your money's gone, and suddenly you find yourself on the streets.
Yeah,
I mean, it's crazy. This is why males, one of the reasons, not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons why male suicide rates are high. And I've spoken to hundreds of men that have been through the family courts, and I don't know one single one of them that hasn't had really, really dark thoughts. And they've just had to keep telling themselves that one day their child will need them, and they just have to keep fighting on. And that's what happened to me. This, you know, I just kept fighting on because I just kept telling myself my son will need me. He might be 20 when he needs me, he might be 30 when he needs me, but you know, one day he's going to need you. So you just got to be strong. And sadly, not everyone's strong enough.
No.
We do hear tragic stories, don't we?
Yes, yes. And the thing is that the family court prioritises the needs of the child, and that's absolutely right and proper. But you have to, the bit that I don't understand is they don't seem to care or see value in protecting an alienated parent, because whether it's a mother or a father, if that parent is so damaged by alienation or abuse that they are suicidal or they develop a critical illness, that surely must affect the child's well-being. A child should have ideally two healthy parents. If one parent is abusing the other, that cannot be good for the child. So, but the family court doesn't seem to care.
No, they don't. They don't give. They don't care about the welfare of the parents at all. They solely care about the welfare of the child. But you make a good point, because the welfare of the child is dependent on the welfare of the parents. And there's a disconnect there. There's a disconnect there because the judge literally is only looking at a child. And also, they're only interested in one parent needs to be good enough or healthy enough to look after the child. The other parent, if the other parent isn't, it doesn't matter. And the resident parent is the only one they care about, because they've already made a decision before the ball started rolling that that's the safe parent. And it's very difficult to change that narrative, because if you consider family court can easily take 3 years.
Yes.
By the time you've had a fact finding, if there needs to be a fact finding, let's say you need to have a fact finder because there's been allegations of domestic abuse. If the court have been complicit in a child being with a parent that is not the safe parent, for 2.5 years, that is not going to look very good on them, is it?
No.
So why would they then say, hold on, we've made a big old balls up here, we've left a child with the abusive parent for 2.5 years, this other parent's just been a victim and they haven't had them. They're not going to do that, are they? It's going to be a very, very few occasions where they're going to actually hold their hands up and say they've got it wrong completely. And there needs to be a change of residency. All they'll do is they'll be like, right, we're going to have to slowly reintroduce this parent back into the child's life after 3 years of absence, if they've decided that they're not a risk to the child, which is in most of the cases. And if they are a risk, then they're not going to get contact. But if they've decided that they're not a risk in many cases, it's just what they call a stepped order, and then you're slowly working your way back into the life of your child. But from a psychological point of view, and I've studied psychology myself as well, actually, if you've been a parent that's been a victim of alienation, what they say is better for the child is to completely change residence and slowly reintroduce the previous resident parent. But they never do that.
Yes.
Even though that we know that's what's best from a psychological point of view. And it's the only way you can break that enmeshment that the child's had from 2.5 years of being in an abusive, alienating environment. They don't do that. They just try to slowly reintroduce. And then if they're trying to slowly reintroduce the safe parent who's been alienated for this whole time, and they're still the majority of the time with the alienating parent.
Yes.
Then it's not going to work very well, is it? Because that little bit of contact they have, they're going to start rejecting it as soon as they go back to the mum or the dad who's been alienating, and they realise that they're angry with them because they've spent time with the other parent.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult to then build that relationship back up again if it's drip, drip, drip. We're talking about alienating cases, and not all cases are alienation, but... It certainly is one of the areas that family courts get it completely wrong, in my view.
Yeah,
I agree. And also, if a parent has been alienating and abusive, and it, as you say, it takes 2-3 years to establish that, and then they come up with a step order, the lack of consequence for the, we're talking about probably perjury, things like you know, false allegations. The lack of consequence basically gives a green light to the abusive parent to just break the court order and, you know, just carry on doing what they're doing because it's working so well. And then what can happen if they are frustrating contact after a step order? Well, the targeted parent can start new proceedings in court and waste another 2 or 3 years.
We're trying to get an enforcement order.
Yeah, yeah. And you could have more.
Very difficult. Yeah.
You can have more. The cycle could begin again with more false allegations, another fact find. What can we say? Really, it's.
I mean, ultimately, in my view, the family courts, they just want the parents to agree. Now, if you could agree, you'd agree in mediation. What I found happens is that they let the two parents slog it out. There might be a fact finding, and a fact finding is kind of where things swing one way or the other way, I suppose. And then you get to the final hearing, and they use the fact finding to say, "Look, this is what we've decided happened or didn't happen. Now get in a room and decide what you want, because we're not going to decide. You decide." Well, it's basically what you should have done in mediation before, but you didn't do. But you've just gone through a long old fight, got to a fact finding. They decided based on a balance of probability, which is a 51-49 swing anyway, so it could go either way. And then suddenly you're going to have to then come to an agreement with this person that you couldn't come to an agreement with before. But if you don't, the judge will just be angry and just probably give you no contact. So it's basically just go to mediation and get mediate. But it's easier said than done when you know that one parent has got the upper hand because they're the resident parent.
I mean, it reminds me of that old phrase, possession is 9/10 of the law. And it seems like...
But it is in this case.
Yeah.
And with the home as well, the family home as well.
Yeah. I mean, I just wish if that really is the case or, you know, how things play out most of the time, the public deserve to be told, because a lot of people then may not even bother with the family court. Why, you know, I think a lot of us go in there. I mean, I certainly did. I got to the first hearing and I was all, you know, the other parent had already filed a C1A alleging domestic violence. It's all total nonsense and was, after 2 years, was found to be total nonsense. But you go into the, you know, totally naive, your first time in a court. Well, I was in court once before for motoring offence, speeding ticket, but your first time in a proper court hearing, and you think, well, this is going to get cleared up very quickly. They're just going to see there's no evidence, and they're going to see that the mother's acting unreasonably, and it'll be sorted out very quickly.
But they don't look at the evidence, do they? They don't look at any evidence until like 2.5 years down the line.
No.
If you're lucky. They might have chucked it out by then anyway, but...
This is the thing. I didn't know that. And so I got... What happens is it's like quicksand. You get sucked in slowly.
Yeah, once the ball's rolling, it's very difficult to stop the ball from rolling once it started.
And it goes back to what we talked about earlier about educating young people. And so they become educated adults. I think at the moment we've got adults who are not educated as to how things are. And we all get sucked in, and nobody, certainly not the solicitors, who are in a perfect position to educate you at the beginning, don't educate you. They just start charging you a fortune. Somebody at some stage should say to these people at the beginning of the process, this is the likely outcomes, or I know you're being abused, but it's likely, it may have no bearing whatsoever on the outcome of your contact or your residency application, or just give some statistics or something to say, look, so we can make informed choices, you know.
The first thing that should happen when there's family breakdown and you're not able to come to an agreement between the children, there should be services in place to help parents that have separated and can't come to an agreement before you even get to mediation. Some therapeutic services. you know, where you discuss, you've got professionals that can discuss with the parents the benefits of contact and the harm that can do to a child by not seeing their other parent, and safe ways to do it, and if you've been abused, support that's out there for victims of abuse, or if you've got one of the partners that may have abusive tendencies, support for things like anger management and that kind of stuff. All this stuff should be done before you get anywhere near a family court, because you need to be, we need to be helping family. We need to be helping people to be healthy. We need to be creating safe environments for children to grow up in.
Mm.
Family court increases conflict. Conflict harms children.
Yeah.
So why do we want to increase the conflict and increase the harm on children when we could be reducing conflict and reducing the harm on the children? And the way you reduce the harm on the children is to support the parents to work on what the problems are. You know?
Yes. Yeah.
Find out what the problems are and work on resolving them for the benefit of the child. This doesn't happen. They just, you break up, you can't agree, you have to go to mediation. Go to mediation. Most of the time it's by a solicitor. A family solicitor. Well, family solicitors' money comes from people going to family court. So the majority of them aren't going to tell you don't go to family court. I mean that in some ways that's not necessarily true, because mediation does work sometimes. You know, there's probably 70. I think it's 70% of the time it does work. So I am exaggerating, but. It shouldn't even get to mediation. There should be some services in place to support broken families, and not just in private family law cases, but also in public family law cases.
Yes.
If you think it costs the economy over £50 billion a year due to family breakdown, it's a significant amount of money that you could save a lot of money, and you could save a lot of social problems if you try to address at the root, the cause of the problem, the issues, and try to heal people before it gets too bad. And that just means you need to invest in families. But they're not willing to do that, are they? Because if you invest in families and they don't go to family court, then it's going to stop the income coming into lawyers, isn't it? And remember, most judges are former lawyers, and lots of judges have got their own family law firms themselves. So it's going to hit their bank accounts, isn't it? But also, from a less cynical point of view, in public law, public family law cases, they don't fund social services very well in this country. They're very, very poorly funded. Social workers have got too many children on their caseloads.
Yes.
And they don't have enough funding to be able to support families to heal with things like alcohol misuse, drug misuse, and that kind of stuff, or mental health issues. So what do? They press the nuclear button and they just take the children away rather than giving them the help that they need to stay intact. And often they'll forcibly adopt children are young enough as well, but it's an issue. It's an issue in this country where we're not helping families that need the help.
No, certainly not. I mean, even in my case, I was somebody who worked very hard from school onwards, and I can't work now because of the effects of this case on me, which is sending me deeper and deeper into, you know, financial hardship. My house is going up for sale. It was up for sale last year, but unfortunately it coincided with the meltdown after the autumn budget, when the mortgage market collapsed, and unfortunately that was about the time my house went. So it caused all sorts of hardship, but also you hear these stories almost daily of how many people are not re-entering the jobs market after COVID. And I'm one of them, but I actually want to re-enter. I'm seeing these news. So I want to, you know, because you mentioned the cost to society of the effects of the family court system and broken families. I am not economically active anymore. And we see these stories saying that, you know, that's a real problem in the country right now. I'm desperate to get back to work, but I need to go through some sort of healing process and to have my case resolved before I've got any chance of doing that. I'm not on benefits or anything like that. So I've always been a hard worker. I'm not the, you know, I'm just one person, but it's an example of the economic effects of family breakdown and the family court system not addressing key issues. And if it's happening to me, you know, I think it backs up what you were saying about the effect and the cost to the wider community. You know, that I'm sure there's lots of people in my boat.
Well, anyone who's been through the family court system will have had some kind of mental health concerns, because it's a really difficult, dark place to be. I don't know how I managed to keep my job and carry on working throughout, I think it was 3 years now, of family courts. I'm out the other side now. So I'm not in the family courts anymore. But I think back and I'm like, how did I manage to hold down a job? And I didn't have time off. I worked throughout lockdown. But I guess for me, it kept me sane, gave me something to take my mind off things. And it made me feel like I was good enough, actually, because of my job that I do. So I am able to, you know, look after my child, because I can look after all these other children. So I could have lost myself, you know, if I didn't do that as a profession, then I could have been like, could have gone down a different road, you know. But it did help me, to be honest. But it's one of the most difficult things I had is during the pandemic. I'd lost my home, so I'd had to move back with my parents, and they don't live in the same city, so I had to drive to work. And initially it was okay because there was no one on the roads. I was a key worker, so I got to work okay. But then when restrictions started to get lifted slowly by slowly, the roads got more and more busy, and it was taking me like 3 hours to drive home at some points. And I was having to drive, you know, leave to get to work, give myself like 2.5 hours just in case I got stuck in traffic. And I was like 5 hours. It's like five and a half hours on the road every day. Driving, I can tell you, when you've got when you're going through family courts and you haven't seen your kids for, you know, a year, 2 years, if you're driving on the road for 3 hours, it's really dangerous. I had some really dangerous thoughts, and at that point I was like, you know, I have to move, and I had to then move to the city that I was working in. But yeah, it's crazy what it puts you through.
Yeah, and it's if it was for 6 months, that's one thing. But when you're talking years, that's quite another thing to be living with. Did you lose your house as a result of the family court?
Yes and no. Basically, my house was nothing to do with proceedings. No, I only went to court to get my contact with my child. I left all finances and everything out of it. However, I knew I couldn't go back to my flat because I'd run the risk of being arrested. Because if you go back to your flat, but somebody else is living in your flat and they call the police and they're female and there's a child in the house and they say there's a breach of the peace, you'll be arrested. Obviously, in my profession, I can't afford to be arrested. So it was nothing. It wasn't anything I ever considered to ever go back. And then it got to, and I was paying for the mortgage as well. So I was paying for the mortgage and then also having to pay for my rent and paying child maintenance. And it was getting to a point where I was like, I can't afford, you know, rents were going up as well. I was like, I can't afford to pay my rent and the child maintenance and the mortgage on the flat. And
eventually agreed to sell it at a very cheap price, at a loss, basically. I sold it at a loss to my ex-partner, which is interesting because she said she didn't have any money throughout the whole proceedings, but suddenly found several thousand pounds to give me so she could own the flat outright. But
yeah,
funny that, but...
Funny,
but anyway, I mean, it was the best thing it was probably one of the best things I've ever done, because it was just, it was a massive headache owning a property with somebody that you're separated from. So even if I sold it as a loss, I still felt it was a win, because I didn't, but the stress was just too much.
Yeah. And it gives this closure at the end of the day. So I can see what you're saying with that.
And also, it's got so many, like, when I think about it, there's so many bad memories that I wouldn't ever want to live there myself. So it's not somewhere, I don't even really want to go to that area ever. I'm glad I don't have to worry about that anymore, to be honest.
Yeah.
I did have to take a fair bit of advice from somebody else that's been in the system as well. It's like, because... it is a difficult decision, you know, to, you work a long time to get on the ladder, the property ladder, and you know the value of your property. It's difficult to sell anything at a significant loss when you've worked so hard, and you know that you're going to then have to work from scratch to try to get back on the ladder again. And he kind of spoke some sense into me. It's like, it's not worth the hassle trying to hold on to somewhere that, you know, you can't even access anyway. You couldn't sell it unless you had the other person's permission to sell it. So, I do hope that I hope it brings her joy having it, to be honest. I've got no malice, and I don't have any anger towards her for buying it off me.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to be. I mean, I don't have animosity to my abuser either. I just want to be out, away from the abuse. I'm not vengeful or anything. I just want the abuse to stop and to have the right outcome for my child. That's all. I think it's a waste of time. I mean, trying to be vengeful and If you're not that sort of person anyway, it's just, it just doesn't even occur to me to be that way. You just want some closure and for it to end, really.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have anything bad to say about my ex-partner. We went through a very horrible court case. Didn't have a very healthy relationship. But at the end of the day, she's the mother of my child, and I think it's important to keep reminding myself about that.
Yeah. And what about your work then with the Family Court Reform Coalition? How did you get involved with that? And what progress has been made there?
Yeah, so we started off as Positive Conclusions. It's myself and another gentleman that's been through the system. And we wrote some proposals that we thought would improve the family court system. We got some other people to endorse our proposals, but then we came across the Family Court Reform Coalition. It's run by Mike Bell, who's fantastic man. He's done some brilliant work with equality and men's rights as well. And basically we meet every Tuesday now. And Mike still heads it, but we meet without him and report back to him now. So we were working on proposals, like fine-tuning proposals through the Family Court Reform Coalition that includes people from Families Need Fathers and some other individuals as well as us. So we didn't just take our proposals in there and say, use these. So we just came up with our own. And we kind of found that we were discussing how to fix the problem and discussing issues like practice directions 12J and how we fix this and how we fix that. But ultimately now we've got to a point where we feel like we don't necessarily need to tell people how to fix the issue. It's much more important that we get everyone on board telling the government that the issue needs to be fixed, regardless of how it's done. These are the problems, because it's much easier to get people to sign up to agreeing that the family court system's broken and needs reforming, rather than saying this is how we reform it, because there's so many different groups out there that have their slightly different views on how things should be changed. So that's kind of where we're at now. We're trying to get people to agree. We're trying to get people to give us their opinions of what they think is wrong with the family courts, maybe give us a quote, and then endorse the statement that the family courts need reforming because of these issues. So we're going to have a long list of what the issues are, with all the different people that are saying what the issues are. So, for example, positive conclusions say this, the Family Court Reform Coalition as a group says this, but then you might have, like, Match Mothers might say this is wrong with the family courts, or Split the Difference might say there's something else that's wrong with the family courts. So yes, things like the incentives incentives for false allegations, that's a problem, isn't it? So how do we fix the fact that we've got a problem with false allegations being incentivized? Which we clearly can see in graphical form. If you look at when they changed the legal aid laws so that you could only get legal aid if you're a victim of domestic abuse, suddenly in 2013, victims of domestic abuse skyrocketed. I was like, tenfold. Oh, suddenly this year there's way more domestic abusers, or suddenly you've just realized the only way you're going to get a lawyer is if you claim that you've been abused. So, I mean, the fact that you could see that in 2013, I think it's 2013 or 2012, around then, you could see it in graphical form. It's clear as day. But how can you then say that people don't make false accusations?
Yeah. I mean, what they should say in legal aid, perhaps, is say, if you're later found to have made false allegations, you have to pay all that money back, or some consequence, just something would be.
I mean, I'd be happy with any kind of suggestion like that. I mean, I could pick holes in that as well, but there's nothing in there that's stopping people from making these allegations. Yeah. I mean, obviously there are true allegations, but I'm just saying that there's nothing stopping people making false allegations if they want to. I mean, if you did say that, you know, later on you'd have to pay it back if we found them to be false, that would be a step in the right direction.
Okay, that's part one. Tune in next time in 2 weeks for part two.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Please join us next time.